I'm Javier Ninja from the legendary House of Ninja, and you're listening to Studio Visit Series 7 from New York City.
There you go.
Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Perhaps since Antonin Artaud and the European avant-garde of the early 20th century, performance art has gained a reputation for cryptic, confrontational and transgressive displays designed to shock us out of bourgeois indolence. Today, a more profound and therapeutic connection between audiences and performers is on the rise. In such instances, performance is about enabling mass catharsis and high degrees of empathetic communication. As such, a premium is placed on what is called presence, or the degree to which one's embodied consciousness is fully attending the here and now. In order to bring audiences to such a place, artists have to act as skillful emotional conductors and facilitators, and my guest this week is one of the most virtuosic handlers of this particular dynamic. Since the early 2000s, Clifford Owens has used his exceptional ability as a performance artist to connect with audiences worldwide. I caught up with him at his apartment to talk about the history and future of his practice and the importance of presence. The last time I saw you was at the opening of your solo show, Better the Rebel You Know, in Manchester. But now we're sitting in your apartment in the kitchen. And in about a week, you're participating in a performance festival. Could you tell me a bit about the festival and also what you've got planned?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming to Queens to sit before me at my kitchen table. We had a great time in Manchester. Remember, we cut a rug at the after party. That's right, October 16th. I'm part of a program curated by Martha Wilson titled Brooklyn Bred. So myself and two other artists were invited by Martha to create new performance works to be featured in BAM Next Wave. So I'm doing a piece titled A Forum for Performance Art. And it's a project that, like many of my other works, involves other artists and looks at the history and practice of performance art. And so for this performance, I'll be working with Martha Wilson, Sean Leonardo, Amanda Alfieri, and Renee Cox. And in fact, just was sending an email before you came with another legendary artist who might appear as a kind of a guest performance artist. We don't know yet.
Can you tell me who it might be?
I can't. I think if she appears, it will be like a wow, aha moment. People will be very excited. She's an artist who, in fact, has been crucial in my early development as an artist. So A Forum for Performance Art is really a performance about performance art itself. And I've been describing it as a kind of living history of performance art. But, of course, the title suggests also that the audience will be in conversation with me about the medium of performance art, about the practice of performance art. So, as in other works I've done previously, it's an audience-sensitive performance.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because that's kind of two of the themes I've noticed in your work, or your recent work, is the inclusion of the audience in an active way. The audience are sometimes made to perform, sometimes made to step outside of themselves,
sure.
Sometimes made to become greater than themselves. And then also this impulse to embody the history of performance art,
yeah.
Which, I mean, we'll talk about anthology in a bit, but in anthology, that was done kind of formally by having these scores that artists would give to you,
sure.
And then you would enact them. So you were kind of simultaneously creating and embodying the archive, if you know what I mean. This is going to be am I right in thinking it's like a public talk? Is it going to be a presentation?
Yeah, I mean, I should really clarify, it's not exactly a lecture about performance art. One way I think Okay, there are many, many elements in the performance. So it might appear, I think, it'll have the appearance of a lecture, but each of the artists who I've invited to perform will create their own pieces. I tried to create this project so that the artists who are invited will be speaking with each other through their practices. So there's a way in which in this project, like in anthology, the artists I've invited to work on the project retain their own autonomy, their own identity as artists, but I'm bringing them into a larger conversation. So I've been thinking about a forum for performance art in terms of some sort of old-fashioned keywords from the 90s, like sex, gender, race, the body. So those are the main themes in a forum for performance art. I'm also using social media, specifically photography via social media, as a way to talk about, as I've always talk about, how we understand the history and practice of performance art is through the medium of photography. And so in a forum for performance art, the audience will document the performance with their smartphones and then transmit those images via social media. So I'm really interested in this case, the audience and their subjectivity in terms of how one documents a live performance artwork. And at the end of a forum for performance art, once all the artists have presented their work, which again is in conversation with each other, then I'm gonna conduct a public conversation about the works that were presented. So it's a way in which, in this interesting way, the audience is experiencing history unfolding before their eyes, and then are witnesses to it and commentators on it in some way. So it's a really kind of dynamic performance. And for me, it's a big challenge because I don't do performances in theater spaces. So this is the first sort of theater space in which my work functions. Usually I perform in museums and galleries. So I mean, this is a new context for me.
That's interesting that you say that, because of a lot of performance artists that I've seen or spoken to, you seem to me to be someone who possesses quite a lot of stage presence.
Yeah.
And I think it almost becomes amplified within the gallery context, because that's a kind of quite an austere place. It's got a lot of like unspoken rules and regulations about how one should behave or comport oneself, and you kind of break through those. So it's surprising to me that you haven't done anything in a theater before. Why is that?
Yeah, I'm really terrified of theater spaces. I don't like I try to create performances that have a great deal of intimacy, you know. I like to be close to the audience. And I think I've heard this term, this phrase in theater, the fourth wall. I'm a visual artist, so I don't know anything about theater. We don't talk about performance art in terms of a third wall. So I'm terrified of theaters because I don't like the idea of a stage direction, rehearsals, you know, lighting, sound, all these things I'm having to think about. But bam, really deflect attention away from what I want to focus on, which is, what is the experience going to be like for the audience? Because I think when I'm performing, I'm often putting myself in the place of the audience, how they see it, how they're reacting to it, what their connection to it is, how they perceive my relationship to them, what my relationship is to them. And I think the theater world is not the art world. They're completely different creative spheres, two completely different creative milieus, two different environments to produce, create, and receive images and art. And the, and you know, I'm trained as a visual artist. So even though I might be recognized as a performance artist, I'm really a visual artist. maybe more specifically a conceptual visual artist, not so much a person that comes out of the performing arts, you know, dance, theater, song, etc.
I mean, I can see that because in some ways it seems sometimes like your medium is the audience.
That's right.
Whereas you could say a dancer, well, the medium is dance and the audience just happens to be there.
That's
and actually
right.
The best thing that they can do is disregard the audience and just create for themselves. You know,
that's right.
Once you hit that, you're like, I'm just doing it for me. It doesn't matter if anyone likes it or not.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, that's the pinnacle.
But
it's almost like that could never be the case with you.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about... your relationship to the audience, like, I wonder how I've noticed the audience may have changed over the years. Because I was thinking, in America, in the past 10 years, there's been this rise of a kind of secular evangelism, you know, where people are really used to investing everything in somebody who's speaking to them. And I mean, like, the keynote speeches for, like, Mac computers, and then you have TED Talks.
Sure.
So, I mean, have you noticed a change in the audience over the 10 years? Is that palpable, that sort of readiness to surrender oneself to you?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a great observation. It's a really marvelous question. I just watched the Marina Abramovich documentary, The Artist is Present, yesterday.
Yeah,
I mean, I cried three times. Yeah. It was so moving, so compelling, and I thought, her audience loves her. I mean, deep love for her, Marina Abramovich. Mm. And you're right, there has been a noticeable shift from performance perhaps just being completely experiential to it being tethered to the performer, the mythology, the persona of the performer. And I think in recent years, perhaps unwittingly, unknowingly, unwillingly, I've sort of come to embody my practice. In some sense, I suppose, my work is defined by who I am, that Clifford Owens, the artist, is the work. But I had never planned it that way, but it's become that. I'm not quite sure how, but I don't ever want to presume that I speak from a place of authority or that my work is about my public persona, my public presence, because again, with anthology and a forum for performance art, photographs with an audience, the question of authorship is quite blurry. It's quite unclear who the author is. And in fact, I think with a lot of the work, I want to give autonomy to the audience, to be part and parcel of the work. So you're right, there has been this shift. And maybe a forum for performance art might in fact do what you have seen happen in the past 10 years, which is really focus so much attention on me, Clifford Owens, and less on the work that I'm making or what I'm trying to say in the work. But I'm very aware of that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In relation to your sort of own pieces, now, what I'm thinking of, say, like way back when you're doing, when you did like kimchi, rice, fried rice and beer.
Yeah.
So let's say kimchi, fried rice and beer, and then take the arc all the way up to the presentation of Anthology at your opening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there seems to be, in your itself, a quite a change in a way. Because, I mean you were drunk when you did the first one.
Yeah.
And then the other one, it's a different kind of intoxication happening.
Sure.
A different sort of energy. But also, how can I put it? I think you were just talking a second ago about not necessarily trying to speak for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, kimchi, fried rice and beer was veering more towards speaking, not necessarily for people, but about something, about, let's say, socio-political issues. You're engaging with that
sure.
sort of dynamic. And then now it's sort of streamlined or honed in on just the personal.
Mm.
So could you talk about your own... transformation from that point to this point? I don't know if it's a leading question, that you may not have felt that yourself, sure. But I mean, what's your own approach? Has your own approach changed since Kimchi Fried Rice and Beer?
Yeah, I did that piece so long ago, I think 2002, I mean, it was a while ago. I mean, I think I'm a better artist now than I was then. Although I do like that piece, and it was a deep...
Could you explain it? Just for people who haven't seen it.
Sure. Kimchi Fried Rice and Beer was a live performance that I did in New Haven. I should preface that at the time, I was married to my first wife, whom I loved very, very much. It's a Korean woman, a Korean artist named Younghwa Lee. And... the piece was politically charged insofar as it was about what was happening at that time and still in the Koreas. It was about domesticity. It was about interdependency. It was so much about my relationship with my wife. At the time, my ex-wife. But in the performance, I prepared kimchi fried rice for the audience. I was playing several videos, passing out photocopies, and playing music, Korean hip hop. And at the end of it, I'm feeding the audience the food I prepared for them. So it was really kind of a wild, willy-nilly performance piece. I didn't have the same confidence then that I think I do now, because I've grown so much as an individual, as a person. I think then the early work was about look at me. And I think the work now is about look at us. I think that's the distinction. And I think it only comes with experience and age and time that I could sort of return the gaze back to the audience. So I think maybe that's how I would say it. The new work returns the gaze to the audience.
And just to go back to that idea of making audiences perform, I mean, in returning that gaze, it's almost like sometimes you are making the audience aware of their own everyday performativity, if that makes sense. So the performance of identity, or the performance of, or the specific behaviors that we were all, well, performing, what a better term for being able to elaborate that. But I mean, so you can see that in your work from Thinking of You, Whitney Museum of Art, which was 2002. So, but in this piece, it's almost like you're making people perform, but they don't know they're being made to perform. Just to explain the piece, so audience can know. So you were filming the cafeteria at the Whitney Museum,
sure,
right? And sort of exploring labor, sort of, I guess, the ethnicity of labor. Absolutely. In America, and sure, how that's quite pronounced. A lot of people working in the Whitney are ethnic minorities when they're in sort of menial positions, but as you get higher up, it sort of gets bleached out.
Yeah.
And so, but what was really interesting was the way that you were, it wasn't really voyeurism, it was something else. It was a kind of alchemy. Well, you weren't turning it into gold, but you were transforming them into something. Performers. And then, but then later, when we get to photographs of an audience, it's more explicit, you know. It's not covert in any way. So what is this interest in making audiences perform? Is it about them realizing something? Is it about them coming to a realization? Or,
I mean, I think one thing I'm interested in is having sort of challenging art-going audiences. I mean, when we go to a museum or a gallery, it is usually for the disinterested contemplation of an object or something on the wall. So I am not so interested in audience being passive observers, but more active agents. So this is why I never call my work participatory. It means nothing all art is participatory. So I think in part because it's really trying to ask the audience to be present in the experience of not only viewing a work of art, but they in fact make the work. I mean, without audience, my works fail. I rely completely on the audience being active agents. I mean, it's a sort of old-fashioned pragmatic position by John Dewey. The notion of art is about doing and undergoing, and that somehow the audience completes the work. This is Dewey's proposition, and I like it very much. And Alan Kaprow, of course, was interested in Dewey when he was doing the early Happenings. So again, I think here's another reference, of course, to my interest in the history of performance art. Not so much that I'm interested in the history of performance art, but my awareness of what precedes me, which is different than me saying my work is about the history of performance art, which sounds romantic, nostalgic, sentimental, which I'm not interested in those things at all. I suppose it's in part my own frustration as someone who loves art, who looks at art a lot, who goes to museums all the time, who goes to galleries all the time. I want more from the experience of looking at art, you know? I want more. And the new work, I would say since 2008, when I first started Photographs with an Audience, that led to Anthology, etc. My intensity, my interest in wanting art to function differently than it is supposed to function. Do you know? Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, there's something in this that is, you know, it's very, very hard to ask an audience to do what artists always do, which is to make oneself vulnerable. But I've seen in the projects I've done the liberatory potential in bringing audience into work to make, to, you know, that they should be in it and of it and a part of it in a real way, you know?
I wanted to ask you how that feels for you then, because what you notice sometimes with groups is that there's this idea, I want to talk about presence. So what happens in the space of time when people come and they're sort of activated, they're made to feel present, is that they become aware, they become sort of active in a way, but there's, and also they become vulnerable. But a curious thing happens is that when I was at the last performance, a sense of loneliness comes straight to the top, straight to the surface. Somehow, in being activated, being present, really thinking, people become aware of their solitude. And at the same moment of them becoming aware of their solitude, they're aware that they're with other people, and that perhaps this might be a chance for them to bridge the divide between solitude and collectivity in an intellectually active way. And that leads to quite emotional displays, and that leads to a lot of intense interaction between yourself and the people who offer them up for this process of transformation in public. But one of the things I wanted to ask was how that makes you feel, because each time you do that, this space opens up, and then when the performance finishes, it shuts again, and the audience go, and then you're the performer again. And I wonder how you ride those rapids of emotion, because it must be difficult.
It's very difficult. I mean, I'm actually feeling quite emotional hearing you talk about your experience being there in this notion of solitude and how that comes to the surface. I think that we are all longing to belong, and I think that we saw that in the Manchester performances. It was so sad in some ways. Do you remember the woman who just, I just need somebody to have a drink with me.
Yeah.
The marvelous thing, of course, is with the Manchester performances, friendships were made from photos with an audience in Manchester. So beautiful. Then they came back as friends to the opening. It is difficult when I do photos with an audience or other projects, when I bring people together to disclose deeply personal things about themselves, their experiences, their relationships. I do the same thing. And you're right, I do the work, and then I get on a plane and I come back to New York. But I come back to my own solitude, to my own loneliness. I am always alone. Mm-hmm. I'm always alone. And there are some performances where things happen to me that change me profoundly and make me feel a certain sense of responsibility for the audiences that I engage with. So it gets really, really heavy. Mm. And I did photos with an audience in Philadelphia, for example, last year, I think. I do a section in the performance where I ask the audience members if they, like me, have ever tried to kill themselves. Mm. And a large group of people came and stood in front of the camera and had their portrait made. And then weeks later, the curator came here to review the exhibition, and he said, you know, this guy, pointed to one of the people in the photographs about suicidal ideation, hanged himself at a party in Philadelphia. I wasn't responsible for him killing himself. But we were all in that room with that man who had tried to hurt himself, and then he did. That's intense for me. Not just because he took his own life, but because however briefly he was in my life, I never forget the audience that I engage with. I go back and look at the photographs or the videos, and I remember them being in the space with me. I remember sometimes their smell, their scent. I remember their presence. So I did a lecture at Northwestern University, and a woman asked me if I lived with ghosts. It was a wonderful question. And I said, yes, I live with ghosts. I mean, these projects haunt me sometimes. It's like overwhelming.
Yeah,
I have to stop making them soon.
Yeah.
You know, it's too much.
It reminds me of the author John le Carré, who's quite famous in Britain for writing like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, lots of novels about spies. He was talking about another writer called Graham Greene, who's since passed away, who's an incredible writer and is incredible at constructing similes and metaphors that just explode in your mind, you know, really, really incredible. And he was talking about how he was operating at a quite different level from you or I, because he's perceiving everything in this way. And it makes me think about you. You must be operating at a heightened level of sensitivity for, and maybe not all the time, but maybe in and around these performances. And I mean, it must be difficult. It must be hard, but it must be incredible at the same time.
Yeah.
But it must be like having like that hangover sensitivity where you're like, oh, the trees, you know, but like all the time, you know.
It's true. And, you know, sometimes when I get back home from traveling for performances, I'll get, you know, private messages on Facebook, and I find myself engaged in lengthy messaging correspondences with people who came to some of the performances. So it's getting to be very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And I think too, what is happening, and this goes back to what you were saying before about how there's a way in which the performer, you know, embodies the practice, becomes in some sense, and I don't mean to be crass when I say this, becomes the brand. You know, and I'm sensing that happening, and that is beginning to bother me. I mean, I wish I could sort of slip into some sort of solipsistic space like a painter and just, you know, toil away at some canvases all day. Painters live a much easier, simpler life than performance artists because, you know, they're happily alone. They don't need to be in front of an audience.
Yeah, that's true. But I want to talk about history. So you grew up in Baltimore, Maryland.
I did.
And what was that? What was your childhood like? I mean, were you exposed to art much when you were growing up?
No. I come from a very working class background. My parents divorced when I was 2. And we went to public schools. For a brief period of time, me and my sister, we sort of moved to all-white neighborhood area outside of Baltimore City. We were like 2 of maybe a dozen black kids in the entire school. And in Baltimore, you know, it's Baltimore, when I was growing up, was a really rough sort of post-industrial city, but not the place it's understood to be now, which is through
David Simon.
Yeah, it's so depressing that that's how, when I meet people from around the world, literally, they will say, oh, that's where they do make the wire. And I'm like, oh man, this is so unfortunate that people think about Baltimore in those terms. But my childhood was, I grew up in a very, very loving family, very supportive family. My father joined the Nation of Islam when I was 2 or 3. So very socially aware family. And I got invested in photography and art probably when I was 10. I think first I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to be a poet. And then I discovered through books and magazines my love for photography. And so I think I knew since I was about 10 that I would live a creative life. And I had parents who could not support that financially, but certainly did support that emotionally and intellectually. Though we didn't go to museums and, you know, do all those sort of things. But, and then in high school, I think, you know, I was, this is in the 80s, you know, I'm 43. I was a bit of a bad boy. And I always like to tell young people, and they are always surprised because it seems so square and nerdy, I suppose. But in the 80s, I used to hang out with Tupac Shakur and Josh Charles, Jada Pinkett. Didn't really hang out with her so much, but I knew all these kids, you know. We were all growing up together in Baltimore, and Shanique Smith, who's a really prominent, amazing artist based here in New York. So in Baltimore in the 80s, when I was a teenager, you know, it's like the city was yours, you know, and it was a really great time growing up.
And I mean, even the people that you're talking about, even they sort of went in different paths, but they're all quite creative individuals. So, I mean, was there just a sense in and amongst your peers that, I don't know, that, hey, expression was a way to go, a way to do things, or...
It was also a way to, you know, to get out of there, you know? I mean, I mean, for as much love and affection that I received as a child, as a kid, you know, Baltimore is still a pretty rough place. I always say if that, in some sense, I think art saved me. If I stayed in Baltimore, I would be dead or addicted to drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I was fortunate. because I was such a creative kid, and I loved being around other creative kids, and being around, you know, I think when I knew very early on, like many artists understand, that I was different, I was a bit of a weirdo. But you know what weirdos do? They find other weirdos to build sort of community. And I also, I worked at this place called Ethel's Place, which was a jazz club. And the owner was this woman, Ethel Innes, who is a Baltimore native, but she had quite an interesting career as a jazz singer. So I got to listen to Ahmad Jamal and Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, I listened to every great jazz person you can imagine while like bussing tables and making money to purchase a 35 millimeter camera and film for the camera. And so I always think, I think so much about, and it's hard to make work about when an artist was a teen, but I think, wow, if I could just try to, you know, I really feel like maybe in some ways growing up in a jazz club prepared me to be a performance artist.
In what way? How?
Because, you know, I love music. And music is the most powerful art. And listening to live jazz music all the time when I was a teenager, I think what I learned is about being present, about making, about being in the moment while being present, while being live. There are no mistakes in jazz. Miles Davis said this. I understand this because I was around so much live jazz music for about 5 years. And also I think good musicians, jazz musicians in particular, have a good sense of audience. I mean, I don't know. I got to think about this more, but I mean, I used to watch Ethel Innes sing and her connection with the audience. There was a way in which she could make this club, which sat perhaps 250 people, she made it feel like you were in her living room. You know? I don't know quite how to explain how she did that, but I had a sense of how she could, as a performer, create this intimacy with a group, with strangers. I don't know.
But then you left Baltimore, and then did you study your BA at the Art Institute of Chicago?
Yeah, I did. I got my BFA at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
And what was that like, making that move? I mean, what were you interested in at the time? Because I'm just wondering, at what point then do you have that awakening, or do you have that, do you say, okay, I want to move towards performance? Because you're doing photography, and a lot of people that I know who grew up in a similar background to mine and maybe yours, is that your first impulse is towards documentary. Well, I've got to show what I've, you know, all the things that I've seen are really incredible. So I wonder what it was like for you when you were at the Art Institute. Did you know it was performance, or were you thinking of a Larry Clark thing, or like, you know?
Yeah, I wasn't at all interested in performance art.
Yeah.
The Art Institute of Chicago was an interdisciplinary art school, so I was mostly studying art history, theory, and criticism, and photography and video. So my interests were probably more in conceptual art and text and in photography, not so much in performance. I came to performance art by accident, because before I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, I was at this very small art department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And I was lucky to study with these two women, Natalie Bookchin and Kathy O'Dell. Kathy is an art historian who published this great book, Performance Art, Masochism, and the 1970s. And Natalie is a photographer, conceptual artist. Natalie assigned her advanced photography class to make a performance using slide projectors. I had never done a performance before, knew nothing about it, except from what I learned in Kathy's art history classes, her contemporary survey classes, where I saw Vito Acconci and Martha Rosler, and I was like, holy shit, you can. That art is about ideas. Who knew? And then I saw in Kathy's class Ben Patterson's preparing a double bass when he was a part of the Fluxus thing, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And that was a revelation to see this black man in this, you know, sea of whiteness, this fly in the buttermilk, making this conceptual artwork. And I was like, man, this is incredible. This kid from, you know, this working poor kid from West Baltimore is suddenly exposed to all these new ways of thinking about making art and thinking about what art could be, how it could function. So when I got to Chicago, it was mostly that. I did a few performances at some alternative spaces throughout the city of Chicago, but it wasn't really a focus. And then after that, I went to graduate school at Rutgers, did a bit more performance, mostly photo-based performance work. And it was a lot of, early on, I was doing more video-based performances and photo-based performances. In other words, a lot of performances that were staged for the camera and not for an audience. And so then I went to the Whitney Independent Study Program, still much of the same, performance-based video and photography.
Whitney was 2005,
2006. 2001.
Oh, sorry, that's right. It's where was your residency in 2005,
2006? Oh, the Studio Museum in Harlem.
Studio Museum of Harlem, that's
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that later, but...
Yeah.
What I wanted... From 2000 to 2002, you just seem to be exploding work. There's just so much work happening.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is to camera. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is quite confrontational. A lot of it is about the body. I mean, didn't it just feel as if discovering all this stuff about art, I mean, the work just seemed to be pouring out of you at that time. I mean, what was that like? I mean, is that how it felt for you? Like you were just...
Absolutely.
An idea happened and you just did it.
Absolutely. I had and still have no fear about failing as an artist. It just doesn't... I don't think about it. If I... you know, it's like, if I don't like something, I'll just do something else. I'll just try it again. But I feel like, you know, the moment, just now that you bring it up, I'm so glad we're talking about it, because I rarely think about my sort of trajectory as an artist, but it would have to be 2004 when I was in residence at Skowhegan. Mm-hmm. It's a 9-week residency in the woods in Maine. That was a radical shift for me. I produced a great deal of work in 9 weeks, and I did this performance, Tell Me What to Do with Myself, and I then did an iteration of that performance for Greater New York 2005, and then later in 2005 I did an iteration of Studio Visits, which I had done at Skowhegan as well. So Skowhegan was the moment, I think. And then I think, you know, Stuart Hall, though I think he was talking about writers, he was talking about literary artists, said that, you know, in your 40s, the 40s are when artists flourish. And so that's exactly when I did Anthology, when I turned 40. On my 40th birthday, I was having dinner with my curator of Anthology, Christopher Liu, and my former art dealer, Candace Mady. 2004, a watershed year for me. And then 2011. It takes a long time to make work, to get to where you want to be as an artist, doesn't it?
Can we talk a bit about Anthology? Because if I remember rightly, the project arose out of your feeling that black performance art wasn't really represented in art history, and that you wanted to find some way to bring it into the sort of art historical narrative. Mm-hmm. in relation to performance art. Is that right? I mean, how did the project arise?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In 2000, I was writing my thesis paper for graduate school. And I was trying to research U.S. Black performance artists, visual artists, and didn't find much in my research. And at the time, I thought, someday I'm going to publish a text. But it turned out to be an exhibition and a text, which was really quite fortunate. So anthology is Toni Morrison has this quote that, quote, you should write the book you want to read. So I think that's what anthology is. It is a survey, an archive of performance art that I want to see. I want to see everything, but it was really clear to me in that early research that there wasn't a lot of that Black Americans, Black British, Black people in general were not included in the canon of performance art. And so I wanted to do something about that. So it's a project that comes out of my critical imagination in some sense. And in fact, it was a huge, a Herculean, ambitious project that many, many, many people thought was not possible, that I couldn't do it, and that nobody would be interested. I mean, you'd be surprised, even when I was in graduate school, faculty members telling me that what I wanted to do just seemed silly, that it wasn't possible.
Really? That they had that reaction to the project? Because it seemed...
Absolutely.
And just to give listeners an idea of the project, if they don't know it, basically, anthology, and you put a call out to artists to give you instructions, let's say, but the term right. Scores in the piece.
That's right.
So scores for a performance that you will enact.
That's right.
And so once you get these scores, then, yeah, it you at a specific time or place or venue, then you enact the performance.
That's right.
And so this seems like an incredible project. It seems like it would just generate thousands and thousands of pieces of work.
Yeah.
But you were saying people were resistant. I mean, why?
They I don't know if it was, I don't know if they resisted more than they were reluctant, more than they were just not interested. They just didn't really give a damn about Black artists in performance art, because there had been very few before anthology. There had been many, but we just didn't know about them. And anthology, I mean, I've said it before, anthology is a gift economy. The scores were gifted to me, and the scores through anthology are gifted to the public. Anybody can perform now anthology scores. You know, the book is in the world, it's compiled. And Better the Rebel You Know, there's another archive, in this case of Black British artists writing scores, performance art scores, that I and anybody can perform. Anthology, and this is, you know, this is not about my ego at all, has, I think, changed the conversation about contemporary performance art, period. I believe it has. So the artists, in fact, who contributed scores are not all performance artist. Some are purely visual artist. So I think it was a massive undertaking, and I still haven't performed all the scores in Anthology. Not the UK iteration, yeah, or the US iteration.
I mean, so you had submissions from like John Okumfra, Ladum Bowache, Kara Walker, which was the controversial one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, which...
The thorn in my side.
Yeah, which I was going to ask you about, because she gave you a score for a performance, which to me was quite explicit, which was how you interpreted it. It seemed to me that you interpreted it in the way that it was written,
yeah,
but somehow something happened. So could you explain?
Yeah. I should clarify. She wrote the score originally for a publication that William Pope Bell put together for his project Flux This at the Museum of Modern Art. And Pope Bell invited me and other artists to perform at Flux This. So I was reading through this publication he made, a kind of Flux-like publication he put together for his Flux This project. Me and the curator, Christopher Liu, saw the score and we said, wow, this is great. And then we asked Kara if we could use it for Anthology and she agreed. So she didn't write it for me, she originally wrote it for Pope Bell.
Okay.
And then I asked her if I could use it for Anthology. She agreed, thankfully. In fact, she actually wrote another score after the controversy called Settling the Score. People always talk about the original score she wrote, but rarely want to talk about Settling the Score.
So tell us about Settling the Score, because I don't, you know, I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah, Settling the Score is a score she wrote in response to the controversy that came out of that original score, French Kissing Audience member, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which she withdrew from the project almost a year into the project, which was frankly quite suspicious. And so she rewrote a score, Settling the Score, in which she appears in the performance. It is disputable, but I believe it was her first public performance. So she and I performed Settling the Score, which addressed all the controversy that came out of the original score. Although I think, in fact, there was no controversy until certain people, Walker included, made it a controversy.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, I always have to talk about, you know, everybody wants me to talk about that score and the controversy, but it really is unfortunate because that drama, that little dramatic episode in a project that took a decade to develop deflects attention away from all the other richly complex, I think in fact more complex and in fact more interesting scores that are in Anthology and the US iteration of Anthology and the UK iteration of Anthology.
I mean, not the most interesting
but
score.
Yeah, by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. I mean, one of the most interesting ones that I saw was the one that Lynette Yadumbuache did for you, which I think, if I remember rightly, the instructions were ask the audience what they want and not what they need. Emphasis on... ask the audience members to tell you what they need, not what they want. Emphasis on need. Your care should know no bounds. So what that meant was that you asked audiences to tell you what they needed and then you tried to supply it to them.
That's right.
Which as we're talking about earlier, smashed through that sort of social veneer.
That's right.
And got to the heart of like the solitude and allowed you to sort of break through and to do all this stuff.
That's
so
right.
Could you talk a bit about that piece? I mean, was that the first time you did it at Manchester? Have you done it since then?
Yeah, that was the first time at Manchester. And it is just, I mean, on a poetic level, just a beautiful, purely beautiful text. So simple. it's so complex to first articulate what we need versus what we want, and then as an artist to somehow provide what people need. Because we don't really live in the US and probably in the UK in cultures where we are asked to articulate our needs, because it's all about what we want. It's so beautiful, I thought. So it was the first time we did it. I still think about that score. For me, it's not fully resolved. It's a work I want to go back into. I think the way we dealt with it in Manchester worked out really quite beautifully. It became more language-based and not necessarily image-based. Although there is an image, we made the language an image, like text, on one of the structures I built in the space. But it's a work that I still haven't quite completed. And I know that I'm going to go back to it. I also love Stephanie Jemison's score, Experience Regret. Do not apologize. So much richer, much more challenging than to enact violence. Do you know? Mm-hmm. And in fact, the way in which I dealt with the Carol Walker score negates the score itself. I don't actually do what the score asks me to do. I'm not quite sure why people had such issues with the Carol Walker score. I think it's because of the person who enacted it. Black man, specifically Black American man, enacting the score. Lynette's score, Pope Bell's score, be African American. Be very African American. I mean, this is brilliant. This is so brilliant, so complex, you know, so problematic, so much tension in that. Simple, just two sentences, two lines of thought, you know. So I do hope that history is kind to all the artists who contributed to both projects and weighs in a bit more critically, looks a little bit more deeply at some of the other scores in anthology, and doesn't literally fetishize this one score that Walker wrote.
I don't think that would be the case. I think history's going to be kind of similar, and history, hopefully history as embodied by you when you perform each time will be kind to us, the audience.
Yeah.
With that, Cliff, I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been great. Thank you.